The name of this talk is Gravels in Central America. It's a combination of a talk and a slideshow. I'm going to talk for about a half hour, and then I'm going to show slides for a little over a half hour. So it'll be about an hour and a quarter, and then hopefully we'll have some time for answering questions. I will, in any case, stay around and answer any questions that you might have. Last January, I left Holden for a month, and I went on a travel seminar to Latin America through an organization in Minneapolis called the Center for Global Service and Education. It's located at Augsburg College there, and they're in the business of leading travel seminars to Latin America. They led about 25, I think, this past year. The group that I was on was a group of about 20 people from various backgrounds and from various parts of the country. I think about a third were pastors, there was a freelance writer, myself, there was a tire salesman, two or three social workers, and we were from all over the country as well. The goals that the center sets for these tours are, number one, to talk to the poor, number two, to see the reality of political, economic, and social oppression, and then with that, to determine our responsibility as Christians and our responsibility as Americans. The particular trip I went on, I went to three countries, Mexico, El Salvador, and Nicaragua. In each one of those cases, the center has local staff living in those countries. They make contacts with people, with organizations, establish relationships with them, and then they set up the itinerary ahead of time before we get there. So the program that we have in all three countries was very, very planned and very busy. Examples of the types of things that we did were talking to the poor, both in urban slums, and we talked to poor campesinos. Campesinos is Spanish for farmer. We talked to a lot of people changing their lives in some way. An example is the campesino near Mexico City we talked to, who was trying to improve his life by starting an irrigation co-op with his fellow campesinos. And that way he hoped to avoid having to borrow rich money from the rich man. Another example is women near Mexico City in Cuernavaca, Mexico, who were trying to organize domestic workers so that they would get a better shake. Domestic workers in Mexico are very exploited. Other things that we did were visit human rights commissions in El Salvador and Nicaragua, at least two in each case, since there's always two sides of the story. The government has one view, and there's an anti-government view also. We talked to the American embassies in both El Salvador and Nicaragua. We visited Salvadoran refugees who were living in Mexico and in Nicaragua. And we also visited Salvadorans who were displaced within their own country, living in displaced persons camps. One of them, a large Lutheran, administered displaced persons camp. And in Nicaragua, we got to talk to a variety of people in all walks of life. Nicaragua was fairly free in that sense, that we were pretty mobile. The impressions that I had in Latin America were several, three main impressions. The first one is just the feeling, the sense that I got. The air is very warm there. It's very richly scented with flowers and also with wood smoke. People who live in the country have their kitchens outdoors, and so they cook their food by wood fires. So there's always wood smoke in the air. The second one was just, it reminded me again of the power of story. Wherever we went, whether it was talking to the poor in an urban slum or to Ricardo, the campesino farmer, or others, we just simply listened to their story, how difficult life was for them, what their struggles were, and how they were trying to improve their lives. And it just made us realize how powerful story is. You can't argue with story when someone is simply relating their experience. And the third impression is more general. And it's just that Latin America is just a very, very different reality than we have here. The adults, most of them seem to wear very pained faces, very deep lines in their faces, and they wore expressions that said, you know, life is tough. Life is a struggle. I'm concerned about eating. I'm concerned about having shelter. It seemed like their whole level of concerns or the things that they were concerned about were much different than us, where we might be concerned about our vacations or whether we're fulfilled in our jobs. They don't have the luxury of being concerned about that at all, and I felt that. that it was just a very different reality. What I'd like to do is talk about each country a little bit before I show slides. In the case of Mexico, I'd like to touch on a couple themes that seem to predominate the 5 days that we spent there. And in the case of El Salvador and Nicaragua, I'd like to give a brief history on each one. Because I think in the case of those two countries, that's a prerequisite for understanding the situations there, since they are opposites, really, in terms of the political situation. So, the first 5 days of the 2 weeks we spent in Mexico, in a town about an hour and a half from Mexico called Cuernavaca. And the first thing we learned there is that Mexico is in a terrible economic crisis. And that really started in 1982 when they declared that they were going to go bankrupt. They said that they couldn't pay their $100 billion debt. Now the reason that came about was several. First of all, there was falling prices in their export crops, coffee, cotton, sugar, copper, and tin. Mexico, like a lot of Latin American countries, is in a very vulnerable position in that they depend upon a very few export crops. And when the prices fall for those export crops, they're hurt badly. Other reasons were rising prices in imports, particularly oil, and the 1982 worldwide recession. So what that really meant was that they had to agree to terms of the International Monetary Fund. And the International Monetary Fund, or IMF, put them on what they called an austerity program. And that included devaluing the peso from 12 to 200 pesos a dollar. They made the government decrease spending, and also they forced them to limit rise in wages. Well, what that did was cause an almost immediate and severe recession, and a big rise in unemployment and in underemployment. And it's expected by the end of this year that the people's buying power, which is it's a real important statistic, people's buying power by the end of this year will be down a total of 80% from 3 years ago. What that means in more real terms is that for 3/4 of the people in Mexico, they can't afford to buy milk, meat, or eggs, and they subsist on a diet of primarily tortillas, rice, beans, and vegetables. And part of the reason that they can do that, that they can afford to do that, is that the government subsidizes tortillas at a price that works out to about 7 cents a pound. But the elite and the rich part of Mexicans want to eliminate even that. There's not a problem of food in Mexico. There's an abundance of food in Mexico. But the problem seems to be that most people can't afford to buy it. The second theme that dominated our stay there was that of machismo. We heard about machismo everywhere. For men, it's a sign of virility to have as many children as possible. It's also a sign of virility, and it seems to be condoned for men to have as many women as possible. There are laws against that, but they're not enforced. In fact, we learned it's so common for a man to have a second woman, and in fact to have an entire second family with that second woman, that there's a term for it in Spanish. It's called casa chica, or a little house. In that case, the man's wife and his first family would be called Casa Grande, or Big House. The typical scenario there seems to be for a woman to marry early, to marry your first boyfriend, have 2 or 3 kids, and then separate. But then she seems conditioned to have to find another man, with her logic being that if she has a child by another man, then that might entitle her or be a way for her to get some financial support. So the problem just tends to feed on itself. And I think the startling statistic there is that of over 40% of the women in Mexico of childbearing age are single mothers. I'm going to move on to El Salvador now. El Salvador gave me a real strange feeling. It gave us all a real strange feeling when we got there. It was a mixed feeling, often a very confusing feeling. Because on one hand, we saw a lot of familiar symbols, like McDonald's hamburger stands, Shell and Texaco gas stations, Goodyear signs, a lot of American corporations there. But on the other hand, McDonald's have soldiers, guns in their hands in front of them. And there's a feeling of tension, a feeling of violence that seems to pervade, that people seem to wear on their faces, and that we soon learned about from talking to people. And the violence seems to be of the kind that's real random or real arbitrary. You never know when it's going to hit. I didn't get the feeling there that if I kept my nose clean, that I would stay out of trouble. We all figured we were relatively safe because we were Americans. But still, the stories that we heard from people about how violence happens, there is a real randomness and a real arbitrariness to it. You really are never safe. The situation in El Salvador is that there's a civil war going on between the government, which is supported by us, by the U.S., and they're trying to defeat a revolutionary movement of leftist guerrillas. Since 79, 50,000 civilians have been killed in the battle, and most of those, about 80 to 90%, by the military. It's according to human rights agencies. During that time, over 1 million people, which is about a fifth of the population, have been either displaced within El Salvador, they're living in camps, other places other than their homes, or they're as refugees living in the United States or living in Mexico or elsewhere in Latin America.
Yes? How big is El Salvador if you compare it to a state here?
It's very small. Yeah, and compared to Nicaragua, Nicaragua is that's an important dynamic. Nicaragua is quite a bit bigger, like maybe three times bigger. But El Salvador is very, very densely populated. It's about 10 times more densely populated than Nicaragua is. But it's a very small country. Our policy there, U.S. policy, is that we provide right now over $1 million a day in economic and military aid. We essentially direct the war against the guerrillas since we feed, clothe, equip, and train the army. Our purpose that we've stated for being there is to defeat an externally supported guerrilla threat, reform human rights, and return democracy to the country. But I think our assumptions there, underneath that policy, are important. Our assumptions are that the guerrillas are Marxist, and if they were to be victorious, they would align themselves with the Soviet Union, and therefore American security and our economy would be endangered. I think what's lacking in that policy is that there's no attempt to understand the problem in Latin American terms. In other words, we don't recognize Latin American history at work. We don't consider the revolutionary movement that's happening in El Salvador, as well as other countries, as a legitimate homegrown political process, much like our own revolution was a legitimate homegrown political process. We tend to characterize it as Soviet expansionism and just merely discount it as simply a small battle in a greater East-West conflict. In that regard, I think it was real interesting what we heard when we visited the embassy in El Salvador, the American embassy. We talked to the deputy ambassador there, and for the most part, he supported Reagan and supported Reagan policy. But one thing he did say concerning the East-West conflict was that, and I quote, "We've got to find a way to avoid thinking in terms of an East-West conflict here. That's not the problem. I'm aware that many people in the current administration think it is the problem." I think the history helps make this a little clearer. In the late 19th century, there was a coffee boom in El Salvador, and that was marked by the elite collecting land, taking land from the peasants and becoming large landowners. You hear a lot in El Salvador history about the 14 families, and that's a reference to the original 14 large landowners as a result of the taking of land during the coffee boom. In 1932, there was a peasant uprising against this. 30,000 peasants were killed in 4 days. In the 60s and early 70s, that time period was known as the Age of Development. And it was during that time that American policy was that we thought that economic development was the answer to Latin American problems. And so there was a lot of investment by first world nations, including the US and Canada and European nations. And there was economic growth. There was measurable, strong economic growth. But the important statistic is that most people didn't share in the growth. The number of rural peasants increased from 11 to 40% during that time. In the 70s was marked by electoral fraud repression of any kind of reform attempts at all, and human rights violations. But it also marked the entry of the church in El Salvador as a participant in the political process. And the way that really got started was with the base Christian communities. The base Christian communities are, at the very simplest level, Bible studies of people at the base of society, or the poor, the campesinos and the urban poor, who got together to study the Bible. And many of them studied the Bible or read the Bible for the very first time. They had gone to church, perhaps their whole life, but they'd never read the Bible for a couple of reasons. Illiteracy is widespread, and also we heard several times that the priest wouldn't let them read the Bible because they said reading the Bible is what Protestants do. No, it's not what good Catholics do. In fact, another story that we heard over and over was that the poor told us that God loves the poor, that it's good to be poor because God loves the poor. Well, they read the Bible and they reflected on it, and people have started to get a new image of themselves, an image of themselves as people with rights. They got a new image that God probably wouldn't like the fact that they were poor, the fact that they were being oppressed by other people. And so that motivated them to improve their condition. And at the very simplest level, it was things like improving water rights, trying to get better schools, trying to recover natural medicine, herbal cures, that kind of thing. And that gradually grew into bigger and bigger projects, local development projects. And they started documenting and keeping track of the human rights violations and the repression that was happening in El Salvador. Well, that grew and grew, and apparently that became a threat to the oligarchy and the military in El Salvador, because by the end of the 70s, they started attacking the church. Hundreds of lay people were killed. At least 12 priests were murdered. And Archbishop Romero of El Salvador was murdered in church while he was saying Mass. You know, I think it was May of 1980. And that was also the time, you may have remembered, of the four American churchwomen who were murdered just outside of the airport. In 79, at the end of the 70s, there was a military coup. And during the next 3 years, I think there was four different military juntas that led, combined with civilian leadership. But it was during that time that the killings were at their highest. About 1,000 civilians were being killed per month. In 82, Napoleon Duarte was elected president, and then he was re-elected last year in 1984. Now, he is a moderate, and the man he defeated, Roberto Dobisan, is head of the Arena Party, which is the ultra right-wing party. So the man who is president now is a moderate, and he has said that he favors negotiations. At times, he has said he favors negotiations with the guerrillas, and he did meet with them once, I think it was November of last year, but nothing really substantial came of it. And I think a question that remains right now is, how sincerely does he really want to negotiate with the guerrillas? And another question is, how much power does he really have to negotiate with the guerrillas? Because the man he defeated, Roberto Dobisan, is the one who has often been linked with the death squads, and he still has tremendous power in the country. So Duarte, even though he is president, may not have as much power as the title presidency says he should. And Dobisan has said that he wants no negotiations with the guerrillas whatsoever. He favors total military victory, and he said he would go so far as to use napalm to win. I think it's important to understand who the revolutionary movement is. It's made up of two groups, a political party and the guerrillas, which is the fighting force. The political party is called the FDR, which stands for Revolutionary Democratic Front. And the guerrillas is called the FMLN, which is the Farabundi Marti Front for National Liberation. The point I want to make, though, about both of them is that they're both broad-based coalitions of many groups. The political party, the FDR, is a combination of peasant groups, labor, student, church, and professional groups that all merge together. And likewise, the FMLN, or the guerrilla organization, is a consolidation of five main guerrilla groups that merged towards the end of the 70s. And I think the reason that those two things are important is that it tends to discount the idea of a Soviet-led movement. Which is not to say, however, that Marxism isn't an influence in the country. It certainly is an influence, and it certainly is there. But the people that we talked to, and what we heard over and over again, was that, yes, we have Marxism, but this is not Soviet-style Marxism. This is our own Marxism. This is Latin American Marxism. We use Marxism, they would call it, as a tool for analysis. And what they would say further was that we think Marxism is more fair than capitalism. It's more fair to more people. And I think that's easy to understand their perspective. For them, capitalism has meant a very good time for 5% or so or less of the population and a very bad time for the remainder of the population. The outlook isn't very good right now. I don't know of any negotiations that are going on between the government and the guerrillas. And there's no incentive to do that as long as we're supplying over $1 million a day in aid to the government. That's an incentive not to negotiate. So at the moment, it doesn't look good at all. In Nicaragua, the case there is exactly the opposite as it is in El Salvador, where in El Salvador we support a government against guerrillas who are trying to overthrow them. In Nicaragua, it's just the opposite. We are against the government, and we support the guerrillas who are trying to overthrow them. But in spite of that, the feeling that I got in Nicaragua was quite different than El Salvador. It was a much more comfortable feeling there. People were much more approachable, much more talkative, not as tense. And it was very, very clear for the majority of people, not all, but for the majority of the people, that they were very, very proud of their revolution. Because they spoke over and over about our revolution. And they always talked about at the time of the triumph, before the triumph, since the triumph. With the triumph being a reference to 1979, when the revolution led by the Sandinistas, or the Sandinista Front for National Liberation, when they were successful in toppling the Somoza regime, which had been in power for 50 years. But that's not to say that all people are happy there with the Sandinista government. The majority, I thought, seemed to be. But there are segments of the wealthy who are not. And the church in Nicaragua is split. The hierarchy, the bishops, the majority of them are against the government. They fear that Nicaragua will become another Soviet-style Cuba. However, the grassroots part of the church is very much for Nicaragua. And that seemed to be pretty clear from some of the churches that we went to, the church services we went to. One church in particular in Managua. It's a circular church, and on the inside, the whole walls were murals. And the murals were a combination of Nicaraguans from the revolution and people from the Bible. You'd have Jesus and Paul and Peter, along with Sandino, and the other heroes of the revolution. So they clearly saw Marxism and Nicaraguan-style Marxism and Christianity together, hand in hand. So the government in Nicaragua then is the result of a successful revolution. The regime that they overthrew, the Somozas, were in power for 50 years. Their time was marked by greed, corruption, accumulation of wealth on a grand scale. The Somoza family owned 26 of the largest companies in Nicaragua, and they owned 20% of the arable land. The seeds of revolution in Nicaragua, what led to the revolution, was very similar, better in El Salvador. And that's people's increased landlessness, declining living conditions, and repression of all kinds of reform attempts. There's three big export booms in Nicaragua. A coffee boom in the 1880s, almost the same time period as the coffee boom in El Salvador. There was a cotton boom in the 1950s and a cattle boom in the 1960s. But all three times were marked by the elite taking more and more land from the peasants and displacing them. with all attempts by the peasants at revolt or protest repressed violently by Somoza's National Guard. I think a startling statistic that that helps get a better feel for that is that by the 1970s, the mid-1970s, and this is according to human rights, international human rights agencies, 60% of the children in Nicaragua were hungry. And that's very ironic when you consider that, number one, Nicaragua is very sparsely populated, and it has a wealth of agricultural land. But 95% of the agricultural land then was being used for export crops rather than growing food for local consumption. Well, that repression and those conditions has led to increased militancy. And by 77, the peasant and labor organizations, guerrilla organizations, were joined by other groups from the church, professionals, students, from all sectors of society. And that's when the heaviest fighting started, 2 years of fighting, in which 50,000 people were killed. And then in 2 years, the Sandinistas were successful and they overthrew the Somoza regime, and Somoza fled. The United States' relationship with the Somoza regime has always been one of cooperation, And it started early in the century, before the Somozas were in power, actually. The Marines occupied Nicaragua for 21 years, up until 33. The main reason there being was that we were interested in Nicaragua for a canal, as well as the canal in Panama. When we left Nicaragua in 1933, we left in charge the National Guard, who we had trained. And the guy we left in charge of the National Guard was a guy by the name of Somoza, who was the first of the Somoza family. And then he quickly assumed control of the government. And that's how he got in power. The United States used Nicaragua for our own operations. The CIA used Nicaragua as a staging area to overthrow Guatemala in 1954. We also used it as a staging area for the Bay of Pigs Cuba invasion in 1961. I came across a quote by FDR, by Franklin Roosevelt, which I think summarized how we used Nicaragua. This is a quote. He said, "Somoza may be a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch." Our relationship with the Sandinistas, actually, when they took over in 1979, we continued the economic support that we had with them for the first year and a half. And that was under the Carter administration. But in the last month of his administration, in December of 80, he cut off all economic aid to Nicaragua, citing two things. He said the Nicaraguan army was getting too big, and he also said that Nicaragua was sending arms to the guerrillas in El Salvador who were trying to overthrow the government of El Salvador, which we supported. So we didn't want that. Reagan then stepped that up in 1981. He, for the first time, approved CIA aid to the Contras. Now, the Contras are the counter-revolutionaries who were trying to overthrow the revolutionary government of Nicaragua. That's why they're called counter-revolutionaries. And he cited the same reason, President Reagan did, the alleged arms flow from Nicaragua to the guerrillas in El Salvador. Our policy now, though, seems clearly to overthrow the Sandinista government. Reagan said, I have a quote from him in Newsweek, he said, "You could say we'd like to see the Sandinista government ousted." And Jean Kirkpatrick was a little stronger. She said, "The Sandinistas must not survive." The reasons for that policy, there's several. The three that I hear most often are Nicaragua is Marxist-Leninist and is aligning themselves with the Soviet Union. Nicaragua is exporting revolution to other countries in Latin America, and that's based on the alleged arms flow to the guerrillas in El Salvador. And number three, President Reagan calls the Contras, the counter-revolutionaries, freedom fighters. The Nicaraguan response to that, when we asked them, was, first of all, yes, Marxism is an influence here. But Latin Americans see Marxism as more fair. And they insist that their Marxism is homegrown, not Soviet style. And I think there's strong evidence for that, For two reasons. First of all, Nicaragua has a very mixed economy, very unlike the Soviet economy, and the church has been and is still very much involved in the revolution. When we talk to people, we would ask people about, you know, to what extent was your revolution directed by or helped by the Soviets? And they consistently were very offended by that charge. They would say, this is our revolution. We ousted Somoza. This is our revolution. The Soviets didn't have anything to do with it. Which is not to say that the Soviets aren't there. The Soviets wouldn't want, that the Soviets don't want to gain influence. Of course they want to gain influence, just as much as we do. They would insist too that we don't want to be aligned with the Soviet Union, but as well, we don't want to be aligned with you, the United States. We want to be a non-aligned country. We want to have equal relations with the East, with the West, and with other non-aligned countries. And I think we have trouble understanding that. I think we tend to see the world dualistically. You are either on our side or you're on the Soviet side. We don't even think there is an in-between or another way. As to the arms flow, there probably definitely was. I think there was an arms flow in 1980 and in early 1981, but to the guerrillas in El Salvador, but not since then, in spite of Reagan claims that there was. I think the biggest threat there is that Nicaragua is a sign of hope to other revolutions in Latin America. Nicaragua is an example of a revolution that succeeded. And I think that's very inspiring to other revolutions in Latin America, like the one in El Salvador. Our problem there again is our assumptions about revolutionary movements. We don't seem to ever consider revolutionary movements legitimate in Latin America. We automatically categorize them as Marxist and say they're Soviet inspired. And as to Reagan's charge about the Contras being freedom fighters, it's hard to be nice about that one. It's a very ludicrous charge. Very false. The Contras' tactics alone show who they are. They destroy factories, schools, medical clinics. They engage in widespread massacres of people. The people that we talk to in Nicaragua, more often than not, refer to them as Somocistas, or Somoza's men, which is a reference to the fact that most of the Contras are people from Somoza's National Guard, so they're ex-National Guards people. What have the Sandinistas done since they've taken power? They've had quite a few successes. Their health campaign and their literacy campaign have been very successful. In terms of land reform, 45,000 people have received title to land, and most of this land came from Somoza, since Somoza and his family owned about 20% of the land. So 80% of the land in Nicaragua is still private. And one thing that might seem surprising to you is that there is very little land confiscation in Nicaragua, which is something I think you tend to assume in a Marxist revolution. In fact, the ground rules set by the Nicaraguan government there is that as long as you use your land productively, that's productively in their terms, which that means you can't rent it or you can't let it sit idle, you can keep your land. So you can have as much land as you want, as long as you use it. But if you rent it or if you let it idle, then it becomes eligible for confiscation. And this fact has made a lot of the campesinos, a lot of the poor farmers, unhappy because they expected to get land sooner than they have. The government has nationalized two industries there, the banking industry, so the poor are getting loans that they never got before, and they're getting loans at better interest rates than the wealthy, and that's making the wealthy angry. They also nationalized the import-export trade, so the large landowners now who produce export crops, they're forced to sell their crops to the government for the local currency, which is Cordobas, rather than selling them directly to first world countries for dollars as they did in the past. And as you might imagine, that's making them happy because you can't do much with Cordobas in Nicaragua. There's very little consumer products, so they're left with Cordobas, but nothing to spend them on. The economy right now in Nicaragua is mixed, but there are problems. In the last couple of years, wages have fallen. Economic growth has tailed off. There have been shortages of lots of food items and other things too. When we were there, what the one thing that seemed impossible to get hold of was light bulbs. It was very difficult to get a hold of light bulbs. And they were harvesting coffee when we were there. That was in January. And we heard over and over that much of the coffee harvest was going unharvested because they simply didn't have the manpower to do it. So much of the manpower was off fighting the war against the Contras. The government, when we talked to them, blamed the economic problems on the war. And no doubt, a lot of the reason is because of that. But it also could be because of simply of failed policies. And you know, the real reasons is it's hard to know. It's probably some mixture of the fact that they're fighting a war and a failed economic policies. The one big controversy that we did hear about in Nicaragua was surrounded the CDSs, which is an acronym for Sandinista Defense Clubs. What they are neighborhood black clubs that the Sandinistas set up right away after they took power. What those clubs do are they're just local neighborhood groups that get together to clean up garbage, to administer vaccination campaigns, and to do crime patrols. And they've been very successful at that. But it's also the means that the government uses to distribute subsidized food. And so the charge by opposing forces there is that the government is using that means to stifle or to suppress any opposition because people are dependent upon those government organizations to get their subsidized food. The last thing I want to say before moving on to the slides is this is a tremendous contradiction I saw between our policies in Nicaragua and El Salvador. In El Salvador, we have a government with the worst human rights record, along with Guatemala, in Latin America. Atrocities there are an everyday way of life. But yet, President Reagan calls El Salvador a fragile democracy, and we support them with tremendous economic aid. On the other hand, Nicaragua has one of the best human rights records in Latin American terms, according to human rights organizations. And there's a lot of hope, many signs of hope in Nicaragua, and the situation there is clearly better than it was under Somoza. That's not to say that it's perfect and it's the greatest, but it's clearly much better. Yet, Reagan condemns them because they're leftist, because they're Marxist. I think the source of the problem is that Reagan sees the world through ideological glasses. Again, he sees the world, I think, in dualistic terms. You are either on the side of the U.S. or you're on the side of the Soviet Union, and nothing in between. Nicaragua, on the other hand, says, no, that's not how it is. We want to be a non-aligned country. We don't want to be on the side of the U.S. We don't want to be on the side of the Soviet Union. We want to have equal relations with both of you as well as non-aligned countries. We have a new way, but I don't think we understand that. I don't think we've yet come to terms with that. I think I'm going to take a break now. We can rearrange our chairs and look at slides. Let's take a break, Betty. Let's start again. This is Mexico City. This is where we started the trip. As you can see, it's very smoggy there. 18 million people living in Mexico City now, which makes it the second largest city in the world. And it's so smoggy there that living there is equivalent to smoking 2 packs of cigarettes a day. We spend 5 days, our 5 days in Mexico in Cuernavaca, which is a town in the mountains about an hour and a half by car from Mexico City. It's a very beautiful town, very mountainous town, and it's a bit of a resort for the wealthy in Mexico to come to on weekends. But it's also very hilly. There's ravines throughout the city, and most of the ravines seem to be filled with pieces of buildings, shacks, and this is where people live. It seems as though many people have had to scratch out a spot to live in. This is just a typical street in Cuernavaca. I took this one because I'm attracted by colored buildings, and that's very typical to see buildings very brightly colored. In Cuernavaca, the center owns a house there, and so we all lived there during our 5 days there and ate communally. It seemed very much like Holden, kind of like Holden South. This is the big market in Cuernavaca. There is an abundance of food there. There's a tremendous amount of food. Those are the big red things on the left are radishes, giant radishes. But again, there seem to be many more people selling than buying. But again, an abundance of food. This is La Estación. It's a squatter settlement in the middle of Cuernavaca. It's on railroad land, and the railroad allows these people to live here. They pay no rent, but yet the railroad can kick them off at any time. It's about 1,600 families that live here, about 25 families per water faucet, and the water faucets aren't dependable. They don't always work. People that we talked to there said often they have to stay up till midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning to be able to get some water. It's open sewage. And as you can see, the buildings, the homes that people live in are shacks. A lot of scrap metal, corrugated metal, bits and pieces of wood. We visited a woman there and spent about an hour and a half or so in her house. Her name is Angela, and she's the woman on the left. What she's told us about during the time we visited her was just really what makes up her day. She told about having to get up early and having to wait till past midnight sometimes to get water. She said she has 12 children, of which 7 of them live with her now. She told us that she is the case of a casa chica. Her man, or the father of her children, is not her husband. The man has a family of his own, and he provides her a little bit of money each week to live on. The rest of the way that she survives is she makes sandwiches that she sells at school. She kind of has the unofficial concession, and then she embroiders napkins. She said that she doesn't consider herself poor, but yet she said she can't afford to buy milk for her children. This is Ricardo, the campesino I mentioned earlier, who lives in the village of Cuatatelco, which is about an hour from Cuernavaca, or probably a couple hours from Mexico City. We visited him because he's an example of a campesino who has had some success in improving his life. In his case, by organizing an irrigation co-op. His story that he told us was very, very powerful. He was very articulate. And this is for a man who only in the last few years learned to read. And I'd like to read you his story. He told us, and I quote, 7 years ago, a man, Michael Angel, came from the university to teach us to read. But we told him we had to leave our farms to find work. This is because we can only farm here during the rainy season, which is April to September. Michael Angel tried to help us see the truth. He would say, "Why are you so poor? Did God make it so, or did someone make it so?" He motivated our consciousness. Were we poor because God wanted it, or because someone wanted it? We decided there were people who wanted us poor to suit themselves, and we decided we must struggle together. We suddenly had the idea to dig a well because then we could farm all year round. but we had no money. Some of us campesinos heard about an aid organization in Mexico City, so we applied there. They sent someone out at Cuautitlán to check us out. After much delay and red tape, we got our well. But it burned out 11 times in 2 months. Finally, the next year, we got a new pump from a different organization. Now we can stay at our farm all year round. But then the people in the village called us communists. The wealthy complained too. We didn't understand. We decided that people needed to know more about their own situations. So we started biblical reflection groups. The people stopped criticizing. The rich man couldn't complain anymore either, because we were reading the Bible. We were always told that God wanted us poor. But we started thinking, and when we read the Bible, we saw that God probably wouldn't like it for us to be poor. And we saw that some people would like it for us to be even poorer. Out of our biblical reflection groups, other movements have started. We thought about what else the village needed. We started our own bank from the savings to loan to people who needed it. Before, when people needed to borrow money for fertilizer, the people could only borrow money from the rich man, and he charged 50% interest per month. There are two main rich people in Cuautitlán. Now we don't have to borrow from them. Another thing that grew out of our biblical reflection was the recollecting of herb cures and natural medication. Campesinos cannot afford doctors. Some of our women, therefore, became barefoot doctors. We collected information from people, mainly old people, about herbs and what cures what. The biggest problem we have left is selling our products. We don't have any transportation or a warehouse. The middlemen do. They are called coyotes. How did the rich get rich? No one over 50 here reads. They took advantage of those who couldn't read. The rich would buy a crop before it was sown. They would buy our peanuts for 10 pesos and sell them for 25. That happened up to 10 years ago. And the funny thing is that one of the rich men is 100% Catholic. I used to think that my participation as a faithful Catholic, going to church on Sundays and feast days and participation at Mass was my salvation. But now I see that I need to transmit the Word of God. We read the Bible as alive today. Jesus was killed unjustly. Today there are pilots still living in luxury and killing the Son of God. Who is Pilate today? Our last president of Mexico. He represses people. Herod lives today too. I cannot lie to you, especially the repression by the North American government. This is back in Cuernavaca. We were introduced to an American priest by the name of Father Mike Colonnais, who has spent quite a few years living in Mexico and El Salvador and elsewhere in Latin America. What he's doing now in Cuernavaca is he's helping Salvadoran and Guatemalan refugees there, both by channeling money to them that comes from North Americans who try to help him, and he also takes some of the crafts that the refugees produce here, and he tries to find ways to get them back to the U.S. so that they can be sold, and then provide some means of income for the refugees living. This is the house or the home of one refugee who is living here, but he lives in that little bit of a room on the roof. His name is Cruz. He told us that he was a bricklayer in El Salvador, but there was little work and little pay, so he decided to become a guerrilla. He said he was then captured by the military in El Salvador, and then he detailed just a real graphic and horrible story of the torture that he suffered by the military there, which included electric shock to himself, but the worst part was the military tortured a family in front of him in an effort to get the family to admit that, or to finger Cruz as one of the important leaders in the guerrilla movement. And when they wouldn't, they raped the mother and the daughter in the family and chopped off the children's heads. And he was very, he was visibly just really scared to death. He said that, you know, the Mexican police are not sympathetic to him, and that if he would be discovered, he would be deported to El Salvador. And for him, he said that was instant death. From there, we walked along this road to visit some other Salvadoran refugees living in this neighborhood, and then supported by this father, Father Mike Colonnais. And they were at work producing some crafts. You see the leather crosses, which then Mike would send back with visitors to North America, and then he would provide them money for him, provide money for this. Now we're in El Salvador. Part of the contradiction in El Salvador is that at times you think you're in Southern California. As you can see by this food circus, there's Taco Bell, Lee's Fish and Chips. But yet you see this too. This is a house where family lives, right in San Salvador. And this is a village on the way into San Salvador, the capital. This is the main cathedral in the capital, San Salvador. This was Archbishop Romero's church. One of the interesting things that happened here, we went here for a service on Sunday morning, and when it came time for the Archbishop to deliver his sermon, about three or four television cameras and another three or four mics rushed up to the pulpit and started filming him and recording him. It's a tradition there, apparently, on Sunday, for the Archbishop to make denouncements, usually against the government, but also against, it can be against the guerrillas when killings, when atrocities happen. And so that made news. This is a Lutheran church there, Iglesia Lutheran Church. We talked to the pastor there, Pastor Gomez, and he told us that he had been picked up and he had spent some time in jail too. And he expected that when he got out, if he got out, that the congregation would be completely gone. But he said he was very surprised when his time in jail made the congregation even stronger. It was here that we met the mother of a Lutheran pastor who was murdered. The pastor's name was David Fernandez, and we talked to his mother. She said that, and others told us also, that David was very apolitical. He wasn't a radical in any sense. You know, he didn't make any waves. In other words, there was no reason for the military to kill him. And yet they did. They picked him up and they torched him and dumped his body in a ravine. And it was stories like that that kind of led to this uncomfortable feeling that we have about the arbitrariness and the randomness of violence. This is Comunidad Fe y Esperanza, which means faith and hope displaced persons camp. It's administered by the Lutheran Church. There's about 450 people living here, and they practically all of them come from the town of San Vicente in El Salvador. They're survivors of a massacre there. We found out that when people survive fighting in a town between the guerrillas and the government, it's not safe for them to live there anymore because the government automatically assumes that people who live there are guerrilla sympathizers, and they'll kill them. They'll simply kill them, so they can't live there anymore. So these people wound up in this displaced persons camp. They brought out their guitars and started singing. And then at the end, we tried to think of something that we could do together, that we could sing together. And so we finally sang the doxology together. They did it in Spanish, and we did it in English. And then they gave each one of us a cross. They told, when they gave us these crosses, they said, "This cross is a symbol of what's happening in our country. It is heavy. We hope that you can help us when you go home." This is another displaced persons camp of sorts. This isn't quite as official. Actually, it was originally a Lutheran mission congregation, and it was converted into a displaced persons camp when the need arose. Again, the people living here are survivors of a town where there was heavy fighting, and they couldn't live there anymore. And the people in both of these displaced persons camps are doing very well. They're being provided with enough aid to survive. But again, this is the minority. Most people aren't in this situation. This is a Catholic church in downtown El Salvador that was turned into another displaced persons camp. The church wasn't even completed yet when it had to be converted. It's about 350 people living here, all crammed into this space. They told us that once the military came and took one of their leaders of their community outside and gave him electric shock right out in the street. And we also learned when we got home that a Catholic lay worker who was there at the exact same time we were, and who was, I think, the liaison to the Archdiocese in San Salvador, she left this camp at the same time we did, and she never got back to the Archdiocese. We learned later that she finally showed up about 2 to 3 weeks later, but she had been picked up by the military and kept for 2 or 3 weeks with no word at all. This is in the basement of the church. This is very crowded. Then we went to two human rights commissions that were against the government. The first one was a human rights organization that's affiliated with human rights organization, international ones, like Amnesty International. And they told us that it's very dangerous to be in the business of doing human rights documentation there. They said 4 of them had been killed in the last 5 years. They said they keep track of people who are displaced and killed. They take pictures of tortured bodies, because up until recently it was very easy to go out to the prison, the political prison in San Salvador, and just see mounds and mounds of tortured bodies. They also make denouncements against the government in newspapers, in radios, those newspapers and radios that will accept their advertisements, or accept their denouncements. And they said they also get lawyers to donate their time to defend people who are picked up by the military. But again, they said several lawyers who had volunteered their help had been murdered. The picture that you see is of a second human rights commission that works in the same building. It's called the Committee of Mothers. Their goals are very similar. They make denouncements. They try to document people who are disappeared so that they can get people who are trying to find family members or friends that have disappeared. They try to help them in their search. But the biggest thing that they do is to give personal testimony. Each one of these women has been touched by either themselves by torture, or have had family members lost to torture. And so they give their own personal testimony in an effort to show what the reality is in El Salvador. The woman on the far right, who you can barely see, who has a red dress on, she gave us her testimony when she was there, when we were there. Her name is Carmen Campos, and I'd like to read you her story that she told us. Again, it's pretty graphic and it's pretty brutal. It's very brutal. But I think it's necessary to read it to try to get a picture, or try to get some feel for what the reality for Salvadorans is. She told us, "In 1981, my brother was captured by the National Guard. I inquired at the security forces. I found out nothing. 22 days later, I found him, his body tortured at the National Cemetery morgue. I was then captured by the National Guard. They took me to the outskirts of the city, disrobed me, and violated me, 7 National Guardsmen and a driver. They tortured me because I wouldn't tell them where my family lived. I told them I had no family. With each question, They gave me a blow with a dagger. Then they cut off my breast. They gave me a blow to the head with a rifle butt that affects my vision to this day. I fell to the ground almost unconscious. One of them held his hand in front of my nose to check for my breath. I held my breath. Then he said, "Well, we saved ourselves a bullet." I was hospitalized for 3 months and 27 days. During this time, the Treasury Police took my brother out of his home. He was found dead. In 1982, my pregnant daughter was captured, hit on the head with a pistol, taken unconscious into the patrol car. To this day, she is still disappeared. I went to the National Police several times. They denied they had her. But in May of that year, another prisoner at the National Police prison told me that they had seen her there. She said that she and other young people were being relocated. The next day, I went to the National Police and asked them where she was being relocated to. But they denied they had her and asked me why I thought they did. I said I didn't want to say. People in the doorway motioned for me to get out of there. So I did. As I left the prison, walking, a car followed me slowly. I began to run. I was shot 6 times and left for dead. Some children helped me. I was in the hospital for 3 months. In October of 82, my brother, who lives in the north, was picked up by the death squads. His tortured, cut-marked body showed up later. In May of 83, another was taken off a military checkpoint and killed, at a military checkpoint and killed. In November 83, another brother was killed in his own home. In July of 84, another brother and my uncle were killed. In October of 84, my father disappeared. He was 67 years old. We found him dead. In all, 6 brothers, my father, and my uncle were killed, and my daughters disappeared. And then over our objections, she insisted on showing us her scar, where her breast had been removed, and she showed us her bullet holes. And when she showed us her bullet holes, she said, "This is how the bullets Ronald Reagan is sending down are being used. They persecute me because when my first family member disappeared, I looked for him, and I made the mistake of giving him my name. So our family was then marked." One thing I forgot to mention at this first Human Rights Commission was that when we went in, there were 2 men standing outside the building, very suspiciously. And so we asked the women when we went in if those guys were who we thought they were. She said, "Yes, they are. They're there all day long, every day, and they keep track of who goes in." Then we went to the government's Human Rights Commission, and it was just really a startling contrast. First of all, it was in a beautiful building, and the guy that we talked to was immaculately dressed, and we really expected to be conned. I mean, we really didn't expect to believe anything he had to say. But we came away really wanting to and really believing what he did have to say. I think that he was genuinely interested in trying to curb abuses in El Salvador, but to what extent he had power to do so, I'm not so sure. When we asked him about the brutality, he said, "Listen, you have to understand, soldiers here have zero culture. They're illiterate. We're trying to teach them that wearing a uniform doesn't give them the right to take a life." He also said that they had instituted a new program that for officers to be promoted, they had to attend and complete a human relations course. An interesting thing that happened while we were there was that as soon as we got into the building, into the room, several television cameras and mics came in and started filming us. And they asked us if we'd like to be interviewed. And while we were trying to decide, they continued filming us and then just went ahead and left. And then we found ourselves the next morning in the morning newspaper with a caption underneath it which said, "Concerned Lutheran group concerned church group from North America was in San Salvador today, talking to the government's Human Rights Commission. So I think they really used us. They gave themselves, they gave their own commission credibility by saying that we visited them and we talked to them. Now this is in Nicaragua. This is Sandino. That's the man where the name Sandinistas come from. He's a martyr, a hero to Nicaraguans, because he led a band of guerrillas who fought against the Marines in 1933, and he was eventually killed by Somoza in 33. You see a lot of slogans, propaganda, if you will, in Nicaragua. I don't know Spanish, but this says something like continue the front with the front, where front is a play on words, part of the whole name. Sandinistas is really short for Sandinista Front for National Liberation. It was surprising. People there are very aware of American politics. They know American politics as well, or perhaps maybe better than we do. Names, you know, who's doing what's going on. This is the capital, Managua. It's kind of a strange feeling because when the earthquake occurred in 1972, most of the center of the city was destroyed. So there are no tall buildings. The center of the city is just barren fields. The building that you see is the cathedral, or what's left of it. It's just a shell now. We had a lot of freedom there to visit and talk to people. This is a textile factory. It was originally owned by Somoza, and after the takeover, after the triumph, the government took over. Now it's run by them. We talked to quite a few people there. I talked to this woman through an interpreter, and she said that they get free transportation now, free health care, free lunches, and there's a state store there in which they can buy staples at subsidized prices. She said that her wages have been improved something like 2.5 times under Somoza, and she expressed support, a great deal of support for the government. She said that sure, things could be better, things aren't the greatest, but it's so much of an improvement as it's so much of an improvement over the time of Somoza. And that would seem to be true of most people in general. They weren't really saying so much that, yes, this government is great, it's exactly what we wanted. It was more that it's such an improvement over Somoza, and that, second of all, we are patient. We've come so far already. We don't expect guerrillas to become efficient bureaucrats overnight. We're a patient people, and we think we're on the road. We think the revolution is succeeding, but yet we have a long way to go. This is in the second largest city in Nicaragua, León. There are several places there. This was a man who owns a leather factory. So he was an example of an upper middle class man. He spoke English. His son spoke English. They were both educated in the U.S. They said that they were operating at only 40% of capacity now because there was very little cattle being produced in the country. But they expressed great hope, because the government had started an incentive program for people to start producing more cattle. And he expressed a willingness to work with the government. He did say, though, that we educated people are blamed for everything by the Sandinistas. We feel threatened by the Sandinistas, and many of us are leaving the country. But this man said that he was going to stay. He was hopeful. He again repeated that he didn't think that the guerrillas could become efficient bureaucrats overnight, and that he was willing to work with the government. This is a sewing co-op in León. They're producing clothes at a cheaper price than people are used to buying. They're able to do that through donations of materials and sewing machines through European organizations and also by the government. And most of the women that are in this co-op told us that they were ex-prostitutes. This is a housing development project by the organization you probably heard of, CEPAD. The people here were just given the raw materials to build, the raw materials for the cement blocks, and they built their houses by themselves. And this is back near Managua again, outside of Managua. This is a home for Salvadoran refugees. There's 22 Salvadoran refugee families living here. And the Nicaraguan government gave them this land to use as long as they use it productively. So they grow corn and beans and tomatoes and cabbage and onions primarily. And they say that they told us that they have to sell the corn and the beans to the government, but the rest they're free to sell at the local market. The houses for these people were built through a Norwegian aid organization. Then we went to human rights commissions in Nicaragua. This one was against the government, and he talked about some of the abuses by the government. And one of the things he talked about was the controversy with those neighborhood black clubs I talked about earlier. But we went to a second human rights commission, which sided with the government. And what the second human rights commission told us to do was that, it said, okay, don't take my word for it, read what international human rights agencies have to say. So that was not a very clear picture. And we talked to this man, Justinian Liebel, who spent 30 years in eastern Nicaragua as a worker there. He explained to us that Nicaragua is really two Nicaraguas in one. The western part is Spanish-speaking, was colonized by the Spanish, and is a mixture of Spanish and Indian. Where the eastern part is still primarily indigenous Indian tribes and Jamaican blacks, was colonized by the British, and is primarily Protestant. And he said that when, at the time of the triumph, when the Sandinistas were successful, and they first sent men to the eastern part of Nicaragua, he said they made some really bad mistakes. He said that instead of sending sociologists and anthropologists, they sent men with triggers. And so, therefore, a lot of the Miskito Indians there have gone to the counter-revolutionaries and are fighting with them to overthrow the government. We talked to this man who is part of the government. He's U.S. educated, too. And we had a good conversation with him. The two things that stood out with his conversation were that, number one, he told us that we want normal relations with the U.S., but he again insisted that we want to be non-aligned. We don't want to be in the U.S. camp any more than we want to be in the Soviet camp. We want to share relations equally with the U.S., the Soviet Union, and other non-aligned countries. And we asked him about newspaper censorship in Nicaragua, and he said, hey, listen, you guys, when you were in a war in World War II, you censored newspapers too. What's the difference?